Welcome to the DuPage Vineyard Teaching Channel. Thank you for joining us.
Well, we started looking last week, started talking about what I call the number one obstacle to experiencing more of God. Our theme for the year has been more of you, Lord, and it's a time of saying, God, I want more, I want to know you better, I want to experience you more in all the different ways that you have. And last week we started talking about the obstacles to that. And one of those being what some people call legalism or a spirit of religion or a performance or something like that, which, however you call it, puts the focus on our performance, on our ability to live up to some standard, some law, that will tell us how good we are at being a Christian. And it can be pretty arbitrary. But the result is, one, we're not drawn to God. We actually end up avoiding him. We often live with a sense of guilt that we're not being very good Christians, and even on a spiritual roller coaster. Paul felt so strongly about that he said he wished that the people who taught that would go to hell for eternity. So he had a pretty strong opinion, which means it's pretty important. If you're under that kind of lifestyle, that kind of mindset, life will look something like this. You'll get maybe fired up for God, encouraged or energized, and say, man, I really want to go after God. You might set some goals, make some commitments, so I'm going to do this, and you have your list of things you're going to do. And you start strong, and then after maybe a few days or a week or two or some short amount of time, you fall short. You miss out on your commitment, or you sin, don't do something you think you should do, you screw up somehow. So you start to feel bad about that, you confess, you go to God, often confessing not just that you failed, but how awful and what a horrible Christian you are, and etc. In your heart of hearts, what's probably happening is you're projecting that idea onto God. You're disappointed in yourself, so of course God must be disappointed in you too. You don't necessarily say it out loud, but there's that kind of sinking feeling like, yeah, I know I'm falling short, and since God knows everything, he knows it too. And then we promise God we're going to do better, and we get up and we kind of rally ourselves and try again and set some new goals and recommit to those, and we start out again, and we get through a few days or even a couple weeks, and then we sin or fall short or don't follow through on the commitment, and then we start the cycle all over again. It's kind of the Christian version of lather, rinse, and repeat. You know, it's just you do it over and over and over again. And it's frustrating. It's not very fulfilling or satisfying. It's far from anything that you would call an abundant, peace-filled, joy-filled life that Jesus talked about his followers having. We look at it and say, well, this ain't that. This is just this constant sense of I'm trying hard and I'm failing all the time. Not what God intends. And that's what you get when you fall into this mindset, this sort of spirit of religion, performance orientation, whatever you want to call it. And it's just devastating. You know, again, I'll just summarize. It's where we create a mental list of what a good Christian looks like. And it might be things that you do. Well, I pray this much. A good Christian reads the Bible this much, you know, gives this much, does, you know, et cetera. Or it might be outcomes. I found some people, they don't look at the things they do, but it's, well, how many people did I lead to Christ? You know, how much did I give? How big an impact did I have? You know, things like that. But either way, there's something that you're looking at and evaluating yourself by. Saying, if I was really a good Christian, I could show it. I would have evidence, and the evidence would look like this. The problem is to try to live up to that never seems to work. You know, Jesus in Mark 8:15, after he feeds the 5,000 and the 4,000, he does these incredible miracles of multiplying food. He's in the boat talking to his disciples. He says, by the way, guys, I want you to beware of the yeast of the Pharisees. You know, the yeast of the Pharisees. And they start talking about, man, we don't have enough bread, and they think he's talking about food. And he says, no. You, guys, I just multiplied a couple loaves of bread and fed 5,000 people. The food really isn't an issue here. But beware of the yeast of the Pharisees. And the yeast, he's talking about their teaching. The Pharisees, their primary teaching was they would teach through the law and give a long list. This is what Moses commanded. This is what the people of God have to do. And he said, yeast is one of those little things. If you're a baker, you know, you put it in bread, for example, and what happens is everything it touches, it transforms. And it only takes a little bit of yeast to actually have a big impact, because over time it just keeps growing and transforming everything he touches. And Jesus is saying, you know, watch out for that kind of teaching, that kind of law, that kind of legalism, that kind of performance thing, because once it gets into your life, once it takes root, it's going to slowly increase and seep and begin to permeate what you do. And ultimately, everything can become tainted with that. He says, watch out, it's bad news, it's a bad thing. The Bible actually talks about a completely different approach, and that's what I want to get into right now. In Colossians 2, verses 13 to 15, can put that up, Paul is describing what it means to be a Christian, actually, in the process. He says, when you were dead in your sins, and in the uncircumcision of your sinful nature, God made you alive with Christ. He forgave us all our sins, having canceled the written code with its regulations that was against us, and that stood opposed to us. He took it away, nailing it to the cross. And having disarmed the powers and authorities, he made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them by the cross. Now, a couple things to pull out of that. One, the Christian life, if you notice, Paul describes it as going from being dead to being alive. He doesn't describe it as going from being bad to being good. It's a huge difference. It's from being dead to being alive. Okay? Unfortunately, a lot of what's taught in churches, or the idea we get, I think it's actually Satan's distorting things, is that the goal is to be good. You know, and I've talked to so many people who aren't Christians who say, well, I'm just as good as a lot of Christians I know. I think, yeah, you probably are. You're probably better than a lot of the ones I know. But the point isn't about being good. It's about being alive. Alive to God and alive with God. Notice what he says about the law. Let's put, Alec, we could put the first screen back up there. I think it was the first one. What he said was, he forgave us all our sins, and we recognize that if we're Christians, right? We understand that that was something, you know, the cross forgave us our sins. But look what else it says. It says, having canceled the written code with its regulations. What is that? The written code in Paul's day was the law. It was all the Old Testament regulations that said do this and don't do that and sacrifice these offerings and keep these laws and, you know, get circumcised and observe the Sabbath and all these hundreds of rules. He said actually what he did was he forgave us our sins, but he canceled the whole law. In fact, he took it and nailed it to the cross. He killed it. He canceled it. He killed it. He said, this does not apply to you anymore. It's not just that it's over or that you've outgrown. It's dead. It's gone. Okay? That's what he says. In fact, he says, that law that stood opposed to you, he took it away. In other words, that law, those list of regulations, were never helpful to you. They didn't help you. They were opposed to you. In fact, they were intended to make you feel like a failure. That was the whole point of the law, was that you were intended to feel like a failure so that you would give up trying to live that way. So that you would say, okay, it's not just about me keeping all these rules. Somehow there has to be something different. And Galatians says the law was actually a tutor to point us to Christ, that you need Jesus. It's not that you need to try harder and keep all the rules. That's not the way it works. That law was against you. In fact, he goes on in Colossians a little later in the chapter. He talks about the different regulations that we come up with. You know, don't do this, don't taste, don't touch. He goes, such regulations indeed have an appearance of wisdom with their self-imposed worship, false humility, and harsh treatment of the body, but they lack any value in restraining sensual indulgence. What he's saying is the problem is they don't work. They lack any value. You know what? The best way, one of the most sure ways you can get somebody to do something in this world is tell them not to do it. Right? Tell them, you can't do that. And immediately something inside goes, oh yeah? Watch me. That's the way the law works. That's how we are designed. We come up against it and we rebel against it. The law, so Paul's saying, you know what? Jesus canceled because it didn't work anyways. It didn't help anybody become better in terms of what God's looking for. You might look better compared to someone else, but in terms of what God is after, which is alive, not dead, it doesn't help you. So he actually took it and nailed it to the cross. Got rid of it completely. And then he goes on to say, in so doing, says, having disarmed the powers and authorities, which are demonic forces, he made a public spectacle of them. Canceling the law was a way of taking the weapons away from the enemy. Okay, got that? Now, I got to tell you, if you ever watch a movie with me, one of my pet peeves, and you see this in movies all the time, you know, like, for example, there's a sword fight, and the bad guy and good guy are fighting, and the bad guy always seems to do some kind of great move and knocks the good guy's sword away, and the good guy's like, oh, all right, go ahead and kill me. And the bad guy stops and says, yeah, go ahead, pick up your sword again. You know, like, I'm so good, I'm just going to humiliate you. Right? And the good guy picks up a sword, and somehow they start fighting again. Maybe he does it again. Say, yeah, pick it up again. And somewhere the good guy gets lucky and kills him, and the bad guy's going, ah. Oh. And I'm just sitting there going, you know, I'm rooting for the good guy, but bad guy, are you really that stupid? You don't give your enemy back his weapon and say, here, let's try again. Here, you know. It's like, if you're in a fight, you don't give the guy you're fighting against more tools to win. Right? You agree that's just like a stupid idea? If not, you've never been in a fight. I promise you, that's a stupid idea. What kind of idiot gives the enemy his weapons back? Me. And you. When we're talking about what Paul says. See, Jesus disarmed the enemy by taking away the law, because then he's got nothing to accuse you of. You can't say, you failed because of that. No, I didn't. I'm not even... It's like someone coming and say, hey, how'd you do on the test? Say, well, I didn't take the test. I'm not even in that course. It doesn't apply to me. But what we do is somehow we rearm the enemy because we create another list. Oh, well, this is what a good Christian does. And God's up there going, oy vey, I put it on the cross. Stop taking it down and don't give it back to the guy. He's going to use it against you. Now, it looks like it makes sense to do it, but it doesn't work. and let me just, a little sidetrack here. It doesn't mean you necessarily have a literal list. You might not have one, but I'll tell you, you have a list in the back of your mind if you have this feeling that you should always be doing more or you should be doing better. Got it? You might not be able to point out a specific thing right now if I ask you what's on your list, but you live with this sense of, I should do better. If I was really a committed Christian, if I was really following God wholeheartedly, if I was really living for God the way I should be doing more. I should be praying more, reading more, telling more people about Christ. I should be doing more. Or I should be doing it better. Right? I mean, I told 5 people about Christ last week, but only 3 of them got saved, so I should be doing better, or whatever your standard is. More and better means there's this kind of law mentality in the back of your mind or in your heart somewhere. See, Satan is called the accuser, right? He comes along and says, look, you did that, you did that, you did that, you didn't do that, you didn't do that, you didn't do that. Fail. And he accuses you all the time. But if you take away the law, if you take away the list of this is what a good Christian does, he's got nothing to say. You didn't do that. So what? Well, look at what you did. So what? It doesn't apply to me. So what? Getting rid of the law disarms him. Let's do a little exercise. Mike, could you be my volunteer? Yeah. People are learning. Sit in the front row, be a volunteer. Mike is Joe Christian. Mike Christian, we'll call him that. I am Satan. I represent Satan in this little dialogue. So be careful with that. I don't want you casting me out, okay? Here's what often happens. Satan the accuser will come up, and he knows how Mike's week is going, and starts saying, whispering in Mike's ear, look at that. Look at how little time you prayed. You didn't even pray at all on Tuesday. only prayed 5 minutes on Wednesday. You didn't, you know, what, call yourself a Christian? Look at you, only read one chapter of the Bible the whole week. I saw how you treated your wife. That was, you were pretty impatient with the kids. You missed the whole date night thing. You know, what kind of Christian are you? Fail. Look at, and you came to worship in church, and you weren't even concentrating. Your mind was off of what you're going to eat for lunch, and you weren't even worshiping. And, right, you've heard that voice? Liars, you all have heard that voice. Okay? And what? And inside, and Mike's going, yep, it's all true. Didn't do that. Then he starts saying, and you remember that attitude? You know, your boss said this, and inside you were saying, you jerk. And I told you, you know the Bible says you call someone a jerk, it's like you're in danger of hell, so you know where you're going. What kind of Christian do you think you are? Right? That's the accuser. Now, the really interesting thing is the devil's also called a liar. So you know what else he does? He comes over here and he says, do you hear what God is saying to you? Do you hear what God's attitude is? That was God. God knows all the things you did. God thinks you're a failure as a Christian too. Because look at all this. Look at you sin there and there and there. You remember what you said when that guy cut you off on the highway? Mm-hmm. Fail. If you really love God, God knows. God saw that. God's mad at you. You are a failure. God knows. You are just a disappointment. The accuser and the liar. Okay, you can sit down. Thank you. Now, was that not good? We're sending you into the academy, Mike. That was your performance. All of us have experienced that. That's what the devil does. He comes along as the accuser, pointing out everything, and then turns around and says, and that's God's attitude. That was God saying that. Now, maybe we need to think that God's not evaluating that at all. It's not just that I didn't fail the test, I'm not even taking that course. It doesn't apply to me at all. See, Satan knows if he can get you there, feeling like a failure, and then thinking that God says you're a failure, how are you going to pursue God with any confidence? How are you ever going to sit down to pray and ask God for help with anything with confidence that he's going to help you when you know, I am a miserable Christian, I have failed as a follower, and I've got no basis to ask you for anything. Look at how I've lived. You can't pursue God with confidence if you think he's angry at you. If he's disappointed in you, the last thing you're going to want to do is come before God. And the end result is you miss out on the very thing you need and want most, which is God and more of God. Hebrews actually says that the whole thing of the cross was so that we could approach God with confidence in our time of need, to find what we need, the grace to help, whatever that we needed. That was the idea, that you can approach with confidence. That's why I say this is one of the biggest obstacles, because if you have this checklist that says you should do more, you should do better all the time, it undercuts your ability to approach God with confidence. You can't approach him with faith if you think he's mad at you or disappointed in you. It's just, you can't. So what do we do? That's what we don't do. First of all, if you remember nothing else, remember this line. The goal of the Christian life is not to control your sin. Okay? The goal is not sin control. Say it back. That has a nice rhythm to it, doesn't it? The goal is not sin control. Now, some of you inside are saying, oh, that's just, then I'm just going to go sin. I'm like, well, no, you're not. No, you're not. You're not here looking for some excuse to say, ooh, I can go fool around with my neighbor's wife. Ha! And the pastor just said it was okay. Okay, that's not the point. The point is you're not living according to a checklist. You're saying, just God, I'm living for you. This is a relationship. You love me and I love you, and let's just enjoy loving each other. In fact, the scripture says what you want to do is not your life, walk by the Spirit. And where the Spirit of the Lord is, there's freedom, there's liberty. There's not a checklist you have to live up to. It's just a relationship. So if I miss my time with God, it's not that I'm guilty, it's that I miss him. That's a different idea. But if you're living according to a checklist, you won't feel that way. So what happens? You're in that place and saying, God, I want more of you. And the natural thing is we say, I want more of you, therefore I'm going to do more of this and this and this and this and this and this, because I think if I do more, I'll get more. And there's a subtleness to it. It's like, well, yeah, of course. If I want more of God, I need to spend more time with him. But as soon as that becomes a performance thing, it ends up being destructive. What if it looked a little different? What if instead of creating a list for how you were going to approach God, you did this? You say, okay, God, I want more of you. I want to hear you better. I want to have a bigger impact for you. I want to be closer to you. God, why don't you tell me how to get there? And one of the things I found most helpful is the idea of a linchpin. You know, linchpin is, ask God for the one thing that has the biggest impact, just one. If you sit down and say, God, tell me how I can get closer to you, and you get a list of 20 things to do, I'm going to suggest that you are not hearing from God. In fact, I'm not going to suggest it. I'm just going to tell you, you're not hearing from God. So you need to step back and say, okay, God, that wasn't you. The pastor said so. What's the one thing? Like, what's the first domino that will fall that will knock down the others? There are certain things in your life that if you do them or don't do them, whatever it is, have a multiplied impact and touch all kinds of other areas. So ask God, God, what is the one thing? What's one thing that I could do so you and I could enjoy more time together and be closer to each other? I'll give you a couple of personal examples. Recently, you know, Anita went to India. So she was away for a couple of weeks, 2.5 weeks, a little less than that. When she goes to India, almost without fail, I fall into bad habits. Okay, for example, when she's not there, I just tend to stay up late at night. Okay, it's like, she's not there, I don't really want to go to bed. It's like, what's the, you know? So now some of you, I've talked to people, some of you have said, man, I was up so late last night, man, midnight, and I still wasn't in bed. And I'm thinking, I was watching Duck Dynasty reruns at 2 a.m. I mean, midnight, you're a piker. That's nothing about staying up late. But here's what happened. So I'm staying up late like that. Now, I don't know about you, but if I stay up late, somewhere around 11, 12, 1, I'm like, I get hungry. If I'm asleep, I'm not hungry, but I get hungry, and I never want an apple at 12 o'clock. You know? It's like, where's the ice cream? I mean, Jewel's still open. I can run out and get a bag of cookies. You know, this is awesome. So here's what happens. I stay up really late. I start eating junk food. In 2.5 weeks, I gain between 8 and 10 pounds. I'm not exaggerating. For this is not the pastor's, you know, I really did. It's like, oh. So I'm staying, I still have to get up early for whatever meetings I have, so my sleep is going down, so I'm staying up late, I'm eating poorly, I'm gaining weight, my energy is going down, I'm tired, which means my productivity is going down, and after 2 or 3 weeks of that, I'm feeling like not my best. I think the biblical word would be like crap. that's actually there, but I won't reference for you. So I'm like, God, I went away on a retreat. The Vineyard every year has a pastor's retreat in the fall. We go away for a couple of days, and I'm up there and saying, God, this is horrible. I got no energy. I'm not getting anything done. And what do I start doing? First thing I do is I start making a list. Right? I should know better, but this is how ingrained it is. I start making a list. Oh, okay, man, I got to do this, and I got to do this. And I got halfway through the list, and I thought, man, I am sunk. It was depressing. I was like, okay, it sapped any energy I had left. The thought of, oh, I got to do all this stuff to get back on track. Forget it. I'm just going to go home and resign and just go bury my head in the sand and, you know. And fortunately, I was like, okay, wait a minute, I've been through this before. God, and this is the important shift. Instead of me making a list of what I had to do to get better, I said, okay, God, wait a minute. What is there a linchpin here? Is there one thing that I could do or work on that would like cover a whole bunch of stuff? And immediately I started making a list of all the things. No, God, okay, I need to hear from you. What's that? And I just quieted myself down, was in a setting where there's a little bit of worship going on. I said, God, I need to hear from you because I can make up a list, and if I make up a list, I'm going to fail. I know, I've got a great track record of it. I've proven this many times. It's not in doubt anymore. So I quiet myself, and I feel like, God gives me something. I said, God, what do I do? He says, well, pay attention to my natural rhythms. I'm like, what? I mean, I would have never put that on my checklist, you know, read more prayer, pay attention to my natural rhythms. God, what does that mean? I said, well, when you're tired, go to bed. That's the natural rhythm, right? I thought, all right, I can do that, you know. And now I was in the habit of being tired about 2 a.m., so, you know, first time I got home and went to bed at 11 o'clock, I didn't fall asleep until 2 o'clock. I'm like, oh, God, this didn't work. And I thought, well, natural rhythms means I'm just going to get whatever sleep I need, so I stopped setting the alarm clock in the morning. So, okay, God, I'm just going to go with, as far as I know, what makes sense to me about my natural rhythms. And guess what started to change? Everything. Because what happened is my bedtime started getting earlier. Not because I had a law that said I have to be in bed by a certain time, but because I started saying, okay, God, you said natural rhythms. This feels natural. That doesn't feel hard. It doesn't feel like a law. And one day it was 11, and one day it was 12:30, and one day it was, you know, it's like, okay, it's kind of all over the place. But suddenly I was getting to bed earlier. I wasn't eating cookies at 2 a.m., I was waking up because I got a full night's sleep, refreshed. I started getting more done, which means at the end of the day, I was like, oh, I'm a little tired. I actually worked today. This is how normal people are. They work during the day and they sleep at night. God, this is really interesting. And the result was progress and change. And I'm still on it. That's the only thing God gave me. It's like one thing. I'm like, God, that doesn't sound very spiritual, God. How am I going to tell the church that? I should have said I got up at 5 a.m. and prayed for 3 hours every day. You'd be really impressed, wouldn't you? And how many of you would go away saying, okay, I'm going to try that? None. Well, I'm not trying that either, just for the record. Here's the difference. If you look at it on the outside, it doesn't look like that big a thing. But it's, for me, been one of those linchpins. It's one thing that God gave me very specific that actually is knocking down the other dominoes. You know, it has a cumulative effect. It's bigger than you would think from that one thing. Only God knows what those are. But I've just moved out of a place of performance into relationship. Say, okay, God, you and me, we're in this life together. You need to show me how to live it because I can't just figure it out. I'm not that smart. I've been doing this a long time. My biggest conclusion is I'm not that smart. But you are God. And so if I do what you say, I can win. Now, let me ram this home a little bit more. Imagine it was you, and what God said was, you know what? Pray for 20 minutes a day. And here's what most people will do. So hear that and say, okay, I'm going to pray for 20 minutes a day. It's Sunday, starting Monday morning, I'm going to get up and I'm going to pray for 20 minutes a day, every day. And you get up and you do that on Monday, and you do that on Tuesday. And then Wednesday, you oversleep a little bit, and so you only get in 5 minutes. And Thursday, you're back on, you get it good. And then Friday, you miss it totally, because you oversleep, and you had an early meeting you forgot about, and oh no, I missed it. And Saturday, well, it's the weekend, so you kind of give yourself a pass. You get down to 10 minutes. And Sunday, you go to church, so you know it doesn't apply then. Right, you don't pray before church, you know, who would do that? And you get to Sunday afternoon, you look at it and you say, well, Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday, and half a time on, so I got like 3.5 times this week out of, now, you're going to do one of two things with that. You're going to look at that and say, I failed. I was supposed to pray 20 minutes, and I failed, man. And you look at the coming week, and you're going to approach it with no energy. Man, I couldn't do it last time. I'm not going to be able to do it this time. Why bother? And you're just going to quit. Or that's a performance mindset. Or you can have a progress mindset. You look at it and say, man, 2 weeks ago I prayed 5 minutes the whole week. Last week I prayed 20 and 20 and 5 and 20. And man, I prayed like 10 times as much. Which one is going to set you up for the coming week better? If you have a performance mindset, the spirit of religion, you're going to look at it and say, that was a fail. If you have a relationship mindset that's about growth, you're going to look at that and say, man, I am on the right track. And this week I might get 4 days of 20 minutes. And you're building on success. Do you see the difference? Have you ever tasted the difference? Have you ever tasted where you looked at it and said, man, I've got this, I'm failing. And God says, I'm not testing you. I canceled that law. I put it on the cross. I'm not using it anymore. So if I'm not using it, maybe you shouldn't use it. So if you have a progress mindset, a relationship mindset about God, this is about me loving you and you loving me, and how do we, you know, do more of that? The pressure's off. If the goal, and you know, we've bought a bill of goods, you guys. We somehow have bought the idea that the goal is just to not sin, that your goal as a Christian, your highest calling is just to not sin. And God says, that's not why I saved you. I didn't save you just so you would be nice and not do bad things. I saved you to make you a whole new person in a relationship with me so we could be on an adventure together for eternity where I love you and you love me and you're getting to know me and I'm showing you all these things about yourself and about me and about life, and it's supposed to be good, abundant, positive. And one of the reasons the church in this country, and probably in the world, but certainly in this country, is often so weak is because there isn't any of that. There's not the pursuit of the positive. There's just trying to be good and keep our nose clean and not sin. And the world looks at that and says, that doesn't look very appealing. And it's not. I mean, some of you were raised in Christian homes, a little bit different. If you weren't, think about it. Why did you give your life to Christ? Was it because you said, oh boy, this will help me not sin? Or you say, man, God is offering me a whole new kind of life. I mean, I don't know, but I signed up for a new life. I said, man, I like the idea of knowing God and serving Him and living with Him forever. And, you know, and you read the Bible and you go, man, if I could live like this stuff in the Gospels, that would be kind of fun. Right? You know, and I was stupid enough, man. When I read the Bible, I read that, man, Elijah called down fire from heaven. God, let's go. I want to do that. So far, He has not allowed me that. I suspect that is wise of Him. I do not think I could be trusted with the ability to call down fire from heaven. There'd be a lot of people who would be crispy right now. But there's a whole life that's outlined in the Bible. It's like, man, this is why Jesus died, so I could share this kind of life with Him. Not just so that I could be nice. I want to encourage you and challenge you. If you've got that, you need to come before God and say, God, I've got this. It's in my mindset. It's the way I'm wired. It's the way the world is wired. I don't want to live that way anymore. When we come into worship, say, God, here, I'm going to give it to you. Let me not worry if I'm doing worship the right way. And just say, God, I just want to connect with you. And some of you need to get out of where you're stuck. Do something you never did before. You've never raised your hands. Try it. I promise you, you'll feel really stupid and free. Some of you are going, man, we're singing a song. I can sing this in my sleep. I've sung it so many times. Well, stop singing it. Just start saying it. Make it a prayer to God where you're not singing, but you are owning it and communicating with God. I can do that? Yeah, you can do that. Because you're not under the law. Do what you need to do to help you connect with God. It's okay. It's what God has for you. Let's have the worship team come on up. Jesus said, beware of that yeast of the Pharisees. Watch out for that kind of thinking, that kind of teaching, that kind of mindset. When it starts to creep into your life, just say, no, I'm not going to do that. And the truth is, if you go hard after God, you say, God, I want to know you, I'm just going to invest in that, a whole bunch of other stuff takes care of itself. You know, sin kind of becomes not the issue anymore. The more you're focused on your sin and how often you sin or how, you know, it's like, it doesn't help you. Whatever you focus on becomes bigger and more powerful in your life. If you focus on sin, it's going to become bigger and more powerful. If you focus on your failures, they're going to look bigger and more powerful. If you just focus on God and say, God, have your way, And he gets bigger and more powerful, the other stuff gets taken care of. So as we go into worship, let's do that. Let's just say, God, this is for you. I'm here for you. I might have had a great week. I might have had a terrible week. I don't care. It's a new moment. And right now, I'm just here for you. I just want to love you. And let us sink in that, you know what? God's really called us, invite us to a whole different kind of life. I don't know about you, but I kind of like that idea. I never really did good with people judging me. And God says, well, that's not the point, is it? Anyways, I'm going to stop there. Let's go ahead and take the offering. You know, if you're new here, just drop in your connection card. Don't worry about putting any money in. This is just part of how we do our worship. You know, giving our gifts to God is part of it, just like singing and praying and everything else is. Let's just pass those, drop in your connection cards. And then, now I'm going to bother all of you. Why don't we stand up? So now you're going, oh, but I don't have to do that. You just said, start by standing, humor me. And as we worship, if you want to sit back down, if you want to walk around, if you want to raise your hands, if you want to kneel down, you're free to do that. Whatever helps you connect with God. Focus in on Him, a God who said, man, I've canceled that written code. I'm not even evaluating you that way. I just love you and want you to love me. Let's have this be a little love party.
This has been a DuPage Vineyard Church production.